On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It started with Bill Clinton when reinventing government and downsizing the federal payroll became flagship new Democrat causes. It exploded under George W. Bush when big government Republicans in love with the private sector ran Washington. And now your government, the work of the American public, even at its most sensitive and core functions, has been massively outsourced to private corporations. The first goal was efficiency. Now that's in question. But so are the integrity and fundamental commitment of some private contractors, from the battlefield to deep in the bureaucracy. Up next on Point, coming to grips with the outsourcing of America's government. Joining me first today from Washington is Scott Amey, General Counsel for the Project on Government Oversight, a watchdog group that has researched and argued against the explosion in federal contract work. Scott Amey, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom.
Paint the big picture for us, comparing today's government and the private contracting going on to, you pick the date, maybe 20 years ago. How has it changed?
Well, I can tell you how it's really changed since Sunday.
Okay.
In Sunday's New York Times, they ran a story entitled, In Washington, Contractors Take on the Biggest Role Ever.
Mm-hmm.
And in that story, they highlighted the dramatic increase that we've seen in federal contract spending and the expanding jobs that contractors are now performing for the government. What used to be performed by a civil servant is now being performed by a contractor employee. And based on documents that POGO received through the Freedom of Information Act,
POGO, that's your group, the Project on Government Oversight, yes?
Yes, we also are known by the acronym POGO.
Okay.
And what we learned was that the General Services Administration, the government's buying agency, had hired a contractor, CACI, to assist in reviewing other contractors and whether they were being responsible or enough. The process is actually called suspension or debarment. Simply stated, the GSA turned to CACI to help review other contractors.
So this is one private contractor hired to review another private contractor. And as the Times said, the firm hired to do the oversight has itself been kind of on the table under scrutiny for its own work for the government.
That is correct. They were being reviewed previously by GSA to determine their level of responsibility and whether they should receive future government contractors. And just the way the government has evolved, that now we've hired a contractor to review other contractors.
So take us back, though, a couple of decades to help us understand the scale of what's happened here. I mean, we've always, the U.S. government has always hired lots of people in private industry to build military equipment and do all kinds of jobs. What's changed in scale and in the kind of work that private contractors are doing?
Well, that's a great question, and you are correct. Contracting out work for the federal government goes back many years. There's many things that the private sector can do much better than the government, and they can probably do it much cheaper than the government because they are able to train their employees and specialize that the federal government is kind of behind the times with. But what has happened is in the mid-90s, and it really started with Clinton-Gore, there was a huge initiative at the time in the National Performance Review, streamlining government, reinventing government, acquisition reform, procurement reform. It's been called many different things. But at that point, the Clinton-Gore team decided that they wanted to make the government run more efficiently and effectively and that they could learn lessons from the private sector.
Mm.
So they started to really make the move in which we saw kind of a downsizing of the federal workforce, but an increase in hiring contractors to perform the normal jobs that those government employees once performed. Since then, the Bush administration has come in, and I think it fits into the Republican agenda, to kind of downsize smaller, leaner, meaner government. And at that point, so the Bush administration has kind of taken that model and really has pushed it forward to downsize the government further. Since then, just since 2000, and here's where kind of the tires hit the pavement, is you've seen an increase in government contract spending from the $200 billion range up to now we're nearly to the $400 billion range. You've seen the number of actions, the number of contracts that are being awarded increase, and you have a smaller workforce in the government reviewing and monitoring those contracts.
More people now working under contract than employed directly by the government. I can imagine people listening saying, potentially, well, so what? If it's more efficient, if we get more bang for the buck, why not?
Well, there's a question on whether it's more efficient. In the example that was highlighted in the New York Times in our POGO investigation, we were able to find that the GSA, the Government Services Administration, had hired six consultants to perform work for a 3.5 month period. That contract totaled nearly $350,000. That's nearly $57,000 just for that 3.5 month period. That's $57,000 per contract employee. So at that point, the normal jobs that they were supposed to be performing would normally come in at a much, much, much lower salary, even on a yearly basis. So the question is, in that instance, did we really get the bang for the buck? Could we have brought in, and that's what GSA has since done with those positions, brought in federal employees to perform those jobs? Could we have brought them in for a lot less than $350,000?
Is there a point at which outsourcing becomes not less but more expensive? What about the kinds of work being done, Scott? What's the range of things that people are doing? Are they really down, are they in the wheelhouse now, at the sort of heart of the government, or out on the periphery doing support services?
Well, it is. Support services is one of the examples. Like, one of the trends that we've seen in the government is now that spending on services now outpaces goods. So we're buying more consulting services, intellectual property services, IT services, more of those intangible things than we are buying tanks, planes, and guns and bullets. So it's very difficult to kind of follow those trends, but it's a lot of those then service-oriented jobs that we need to monitor, and we need to make sure that they're in check and the prices that the government is paying are fair and reasonable.
And what about the priorities and the agenda that people doing these services are bringing to the tasks? If they're services, does that take them right into near the heart of policy making? Do we have profit-making corporations now deciding what the government's going to do?
Well, that is kind of the million-dollar question right now. In Washington, one of the terms that being batted around a lot is inherently governmental functions, which is functions that are core functions of the federal government that federal employees should be performing. The question is becoming, are there being lines crossed from the commercial work over into the jobs or the functions that are listed as inherently governmental? And do we have then people from the commercial sector then operating, running policies in positions that they should not be in?
So what's your core concern here? Is it about competence in getting this work done cost effectively? Or is it about, corporations are profit driven, about corporations turning the government into a big cash cow with that as their number one priority?
Well, I think they're both. The first thing is that we have to look at is the control of the federal government with the amount of lobbying that takes place in Washington, D.C. We already know that there is some kind of corporate influence over policy, whether it's in Congress or in the executive branch. But the question is now, have they infiltrated the federal government to a point where they're controlling policy from inside? The number of political appointees and where they're coming from is a real concern with, is there a top-down influence over now policy that has a lean toward the private or the corporate sector. And then also financial, and no one's really done it yet. And that's what I'm hoping that the federal government or the GAO or someone that has some kind of investigative arm will take a look at, is this outsourcing truly working? Are we really saving money? And if so, how much?
Your watchdog group, do you have the same access, the same transparency when it's private contractor as you would with public servants doing this work, or is it a black box?
No, we are somewhat limited. We do have the Freedom of Information Act, which allows us access to federal documents and materials. But when it comes to corporate materials, they are protected and they have proprietary designations. So they are much more difficult for us to see. And even in government reports, anything that is considered commercial proprietary data is usually redacted. So at that point, I don't get to see it in my position.
Hard to know who's doing what. Scott, Amy, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Stan Soloway. He's president of the Professional Services Council. It is an organization that represents private contractors doing work for the government. Stan Soloway, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's nice to be here.
So here it's been laid out on the table in a very critical way, saying, well, wait a minute, maybe this has gone too far. Maybe too much of our government work is being done by private hands. Not enough competition, not enough oversight, not enough transparency. A fair critique. Stan, are you worried about the extent of private contracting, or is this a net advantage for the American people?
My primary worry really is about the quality of the discussion and the dialogue, because I think there are a lot of issues we need to be talking about. This is a new face of government. Government has been transforming over a 20-year period of time, and I think there are plenty of challenges worth talking about. But it's hard to do it when you have a lot of things thrown out in a laundry list where the facts aren't actually laid out on the table, just a lot of suggestion and hyperbole. And whether it's the case with GSA and the suspension and debarment contract or other issues that have come up, and then I think there's a whole lot of stuff worth talking about. The fundamental issue here is the premise of Scott, and who I've worked with in the past, that this has all been part of a political agenda from the Clinton administration in which I served through the Bush administration. And I think while there may have been attempts to, and clearly are attempts, to modernize and transform government, to rely on the private sector more where it makes sense and so forth, the fundamental driver behind this explosion and this new integration of the public and private sectors is really a massive change in the general economy and in the way institutions, business process, and technology is managed and being developed. And as the government has tried to transform and modernize itself, as Scott himself said, the government is well, way behind in terms of maintaining currency on business process, on developing and its people and so forth. It has a huge demographic challenge. More than, I think there's 2.5 times as many people over 55 as under 30 in the federal government today. You have an incredibly dedicated civil service, but the government for years, decades, perhaps forever, has simply not invested in its people and invested in the way the private sector has in improving business process. So as we've tried to modernize and transform, now you're competing in a marketplace for talent with the rest of the world. It's not just government contractors. Mm-hmm. The kinds of people the government needs are the same kinds of people that purely commercial companies need, government contractors need, and so forth. So that's really the underpinning and the driver.
I've been joined by Stan Soloway. He's president of the Professional Services Council. That's an organization that represents contractors doing work for the U.S. government. He's former Deputy Undersecretary of Defense in the Clinton administration, responsible for acquisition reform. We're also joined from Washington by Scott Amey. He's general counsel at the Project on Government Oversight. They've been very critical of the massive move to private contracting of public services. We're joined now from Washington as well by Angela Stiles. She is former chief of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy in the Office of Management and Budget. She was the top procurement officer in the Bush administration until she resigned in 2003. At that time, she warned that the chickens would come home to roost. We'll ask her what she means by that. She's currently at the Washington law firm Myler and Chevalier. Her clients include federal contractors. Angela Stiles, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
What were you warning about when you said, when it came to private contracting of government work, that the chickens would come home to roost?
Well, I think we were starting to see a good number of problems in the period of time that I was at the White House. We looked back over the past. We saw that the contracting rules had been changed in the mid-90s. They'd become a little bit more subjective. There were many, many good changes that made it easier for the government to buy, but it also made it easier for the government to buy, and it made it subjective. We had a huge cut in the contractor workforce. There weren't as many people actually reviewing the actions, overseeing the actions, managing the actions. And we also had this extraordinary increase in technology. We had changes in technology that we had never seen before. And we came to realize that there weren't very many people in the federal government that understood the technology that they were buying. We also realized that in that time frame, we were moving from spending about $200 billion a year under a system that was having a little bit of difficulty handling $200 billion. Mm-hmm. And we increased that spending to the private sector to $400 billion. It's almost impossible, even if the system was working perfectly, to double the amount of money from $200 billion to $400 billion and expect it to work right all the time.
So what are the consequences if it's not working right? I mean, when American citizens look at it, what should they be concerned about?
I think the most significant concern is how the money's spent. Is it spent effectively? Is it managed effectively? Are we buying the right things to fight terrorism? Are we buying the right things to protect the homeland? Are we doing it in the best way we can and managing the taxpayers' money in the right way? That's the biggest risk.
And is there a sheer volume question here, you're saying, when it's gone from $200 billion to $400 billion? Is that just too much? Is there a point at which, I don't know, some arbitrary or reasoned point at which too much of the government's work is in private hands?
It's not that too much of the work is in private hands. You just have to make changes in the system to match the amount of money that you're spending. You have to make sure that the rules work right, that the people are trained, that there's enough people there to execute the contracts and to manage the contracts, to understand the technology that they're buying, to oversee those contracts. And, you know, we were having a little bit of trouble in a system with $200 billion, and you have to make significant changes to manage significantly more money.
Scott Amey, Stan Soloway says, let's get specific here. What do you see when you're critical of this very large movement? What do you see as the specific consequences that worry you?
Well, I think Angela hit the nail on the head. It's a matter of how we are managing the money that we're spending and what we are buying. It ends up being just good buying decisions. We all do this in our normal everyday lives, and there's a real theory that the government is spending money. We don't know what we're getting. We're not spending it under different contracting vehicles the best way possible to save money for the taxpayers. And it's a matter of, and this is where the government does split from the private sector in the way they operate, is we are spending taxpayer dollars. If some of this money boils down to extra money on the bottom line or extra profit for a company, that's one thing. But when it's our money, when it's taxpayer money, there needs to be the processes that Angela was just describing installed into the system that make sure that money's being spent wisely. And that's where we have our biggest concerns.
Stan Soloway, we just had this report recently, bipartisan, from the Acquisition Advisory Panel. And quoting some of their findings here, they said this trend to private contracting, quote, poses a threat to the government's long-term ability to perform its mission and, quote, could undermine the integrity of the government's decision-making. Those look like awfully big red flags. It's bipartisan. Are they out of line?
Well, I'm sitting here sort of smiling to myself listening to all this conversation, wondering when
you
we're
think
actually
it's funny.
No, I don't think it's funny. I think that I'm wondering when we're going to actually start to put some context on the discussion. What Angela said about the workforce and the challenge of the workforce is absolutely correct. But let's be very clear about something. When I was at DOD, I had responsibility for the acquisition workforce. It was almost 200,000 people. And we fought every day with the Congress that was trying to cut the acquisition workforce. It wasn't the Clinton administration that was trying to cut them. You know, workforce cuts, depending on where the cuts take place, how do you strategically plan your workforce? We are absolutely in agreement with what Scott just said and what Angela just said and what my organization would say. We're all singing Kumbaya. That's not really where a lot of the political emphasis is today. And the problem is what we're not focusing on is what has the inspectors general told us? What has the GAO told us? What did the acquisition advisory panel really say?
So it poses a threat to the government's long-term ability to perform its mission. That looks like a pretty big context to me.
But what their report really pointed to is what Angela just talked about, was do we have an acquisition community that is resourced and supported and skilled to manage in this new environment? Now, to the extent that there are some gray areas that we need to discuss because of this technology explosion, the government's absolute inability to hire people and so forth, that has created a gray area of what is being bought and by whom— that's a perfectly appropriate discussion, but it all has to be done in context. And so when I hear Scott say things like, isn't this awful that this one company got this GSA contract? And then I look, well, the company had been under scrutiny, but guess what? They were cleared. And the last time I checked in our legal system, when you're cleared, you're cleared. And what were they doing? They weren't actually making decisions on suspension and debarment. GSA had a backlog. And so they hired a contractor for 3 months to help them erase the backlog to do exactly the kinds of things that POGO wants done more of, which is looking significantly at suspension and debarment. And so then the comment comes back, well, but the costs were exorbitant. Yes. Well, guess what?
$104 an hour, we read.
Right. One of the reasons GSA and other government agencies, one of the main reasons they struggle to hire people is because of what's called the pay gap. That is the talent and the skills that the government needs, the kinds of things Angela's talking about, which are principally resident in the private sector. The marketplace has determined the value of those people is much higher than that which the government is usually paying. So a comparison of $104 an hour rate for a part-time, highly skilled consultant to come in and help erase this backlog against a traditional government measurement of what the salary might be is apples to oranges. Mm. Part of the issue here is that when we look at cost as an issue, many times when you're trying to convert functions, you look at whether there's a cost advantage. But many times the issue isn't really cost. It comes back to the skill sets. It comes back to the agility. Now, there's a lot of other factors. And so if the marketplace has decided, if I'm building a home and I want a top quality plumber, the marketplace will have decided that a journeyman plumber with certain vocational and other training is worth one thing, whereas the guy down the street might be less expensive. But if he's not current on his skills, it's going to cost me more in the long run.
Stand by, if you would. Angela Stiles, what about it? Is this are we just misunderstanding the beauty of the private sector here? Is it about gray areas or the acquisition advisory panel? Again, they're saying some pretty big things here, that the massive move to private contracting poses a threat to the government's long-term ability to perform its mission. You hear Stan begging to differ and describing, you know, where it may be worth paying more, but we're trying to get exactly the big picture here. And do you see it? Do you see it as, again, their words, undermining the integrity of the government's decision-making? That sounds big.
Well, I think the report points to several recommendations. I think they report to significant regulatory changes. I think they point to greater transparency in the system. And I think they've identified exactly what Stan is talking about, which is a huge problem with our civil service system, which does not allow the federal government to hire the people that they need and pay them what they need to pay them.
That doesn't mean when we talk about hiring people to pay them that the government is going to be able to hire the technology workforce it needs, for instance, because that's probably off the table in many ways. But what Angela and I and others talk about is acquisition people, program management, contract administration, those kinds of skills the government should be able to compete well for, but it doesn't. We have to ask why.
What's your answer?
I think that Angela just put her finger on it, that we do not invest in people. We as industry, you know, people like to make us out to be, you know, the big ogres. We've been aggressively pushing for years for more funding put aside for contract training, acquisition training. There's an adage in business that is true, although many people don't believe it, that a smart customer is a good customer. We've been aggressively advocating training funding. Building the acquisition workforce, as I said, it was Congress, not the Clinton administration, that was trying to cut the acquisition community. And I think there are the real gains that we could make to address the issues. And I understand the concern. I'm not trying to whitewash. You have a system of $400 billion and 30 million transactions a year and the workforce problems that we've got. There are going to be challenges. There are going to be bad apples. There are going to be mistakes made. The current environment assumes that every mistake is a scandal and abuse. When the inspector general comes out in Iraq reconstruction and says there's precious little evidence of fraud in Iraq contracting, but there's a lot of issues about how it's been managed and so forth, you need to separate those issues out and focus on the real issue and the real area that's going to deliver results. And that, as Angela just said, it's the workforce and it's the system that supports that workforce. That's where the real results are
going to
come.
$400 billion going to private contractors. You'll forgive us if we're going to be very skeptical. You know,
I understand the skepticism.
Watching the civil service and the federal bureaucracy. But when we see now, what, less than half of these, this contract action competitive and the scale of that money, Angela Stiles saying it's more than the government can reasonably handle. I mean, all the way back to, what, you name it, Harry Truman saying, you know, watch out because private industry is perfectly willing to treat government money like one big fat turkey. We've seen that for a long time. Let me get to our callers. In Virginia Beach, Virginia, Victor's calling. Victor, you're on the air.
Yeah, I applaud the gentleman for making all those statements about the quality of the people the government is getting, the technology education they have, the skills that they are bringing to the job. But obviously, he has not been on the ground in Iraq to see the caliber of some of the contractors they're hiring. These people are just grabbing anyone they can grab that is willing, that has not even the level of skills that is needed to be out in the field, and they're moving them out there. And as for the money being misappropriated, the real victim is the citizens of this country.
Have you been there, Victor? Have you seen it firsthand?
I was over there for 9 months. I saw people renting a Ford Escort. The government is paying $15,000 for a Ford Escort or for a Ford Blazer. Even a blind man or a crazy person would not rent that kind of a vehicle, a Ford Explorer, for $15,000.
So there's a voice from the front in Iraq saying, don't be so sure you're getting top quality service there. Let's get the voice of someone who's been there. A reporter, T. Christian Miller, joins us from the Los Angeles Times, investigative reporter for the L.A. Times. He's joining us today from Santa Rosa, California. He's author of Blood Money, Wasted Billions, Lost Lives, and Corporate Greed in Iraq. T. Christian Miller, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So what about the privatization of government services, private contractors in Iraq? Stan Soloway, one of our guests here, is saying they're doing pretty darn well. Our caller says, up close, that's not what he saw. What did you see?
Well, I think Iraq is the concentration of all the problems that your guests have been talking about. If there are problems with oversight and contracting in the United States, once you move that whole situation, that whole machinery overseas to a hostile war zone, everything gets exacerbated by a factor of 10 or 100. So while the Stan is correct, the Special Inspector General for Iraq has said that fraud isn't a huge part of the contracting issue over there, it certainly has played a pretty significant role. And the other part of that story, which is the waste that goes on and the abuse of this contracting system, which goes on, I would say is much more pronounced over in Iraq than anything we've seen over in the United States. So Iraq definitely is sort of an open sore in the whole contracting system, and the ability of the government to monitor and oversee contractors. And there's been an endless parade of examples over there.
Do you see the government representatives in Iraq rolling their eyes and saying, we've been saddled with all this private contracting, or are they happy to have it because they don't have the capacity or the skills themselves?
You see contracting officers over there who are just completely overwhelmed, and it's not like it's a big secret, and you can talk to any of them. There was one point in time early on in the invasion when there were exactly two contract officers in the entire country of Iraq working for the Coalition Provisional Authority, as it was then called, to do all the contracting for a $14 billion a year organization. And nobody's going to tell you that you have enough contract officers over there to oversee even the most basic kind of work. At the same time, it is also abundantly clear over in Iraq that you could not do the job you're doing without contractors. There's something like 100,000 contractors over in Iraq right now, according to a recent CENTCOM survey. That's almost a one-to-one ratio of contractors to U.S. soldiers. And that's an extraordinary figure that we've never reached anything close to that in any kind of past war we've had.
Angela Stiles, I'll go to Angela Stiles for a moment. Is Iraq Exhibit A of the problem, or is it an example of how private contracting, you know, is an important supplement to government capacity, Angela?
Well, I think it's both. Mm-hmm. We couldn't do it. I mean, our military couldn't operate without private contractors. They bring the tents. They bring the food. You know, they're willing to go into, you know, scary and difficult parts of the world, and they've performed time and time again for us. But, you know, you end up in a situation like that, and you end up with all this money out there. There are people on both sides in the private sector and the government that are going to take advantage of the situation. They're going to overcharge. There's going to be misuse. There are going to be problems in a situation where you don't have enough people to oversee what's going on, where there's no transparency in the situation, and there aren't well-established rules for how it's supposed to be done.
Stan Soloway, gone too far in Iraq?
Well, let's back up again. Maybe context would help here. The 100,000.
Are you the only person who has any context? I'm not hearing that personally, Stan. I'm really not.
I know. I apologize if I sound a little flip.
Yeah, you do.
Let me back up on the Iraq question. The 100,000 contractors, and most of whom are not U.S. citizens, of course, because we hire from companies from all over the world and so forth. But of the 100,000 contractors, you have to recognize that what's going on in Iraq is three contiguous missions. There's the military operation, there's the physical reconstruction of the country, and there's the economic and other development. We have never in the history of the country tried to do those three missions concurrently. And that is what's driving. It's not just the number of contractors when we say it's one-to-one with soldiers. That implies that there's one contractor to support every soldier doing the military mission. You've got to separate this out and look at it that way. And I think that Angela's correct when she talks about, and Chris Miller is correct in his book when he talks about the fact that we had this massive requirement and a completely inadequate number of people going over there. We were briefing as industry, the Defense Department. We were involved with the Special Inspector General Lessons Learned teams, with the Army Lessons Learned. The number one theme that came out of all of this is exactly what he just said, which is we had inadequate resources in country to manage the operation broadly and, of course, the flow of dollars, whether it was contract or local grants or what have you.
We're talking this hour about the contracting out of the U.S. government, the outsourcing and privatizing of the public's work on many, many fronts these days. We've been joined by Scott Amey. He's general counsel for the Project on Government Oversight. Angela Stiles is with us. She's former chief of the Office of Federal Procurement Policy in the Office of Management and Budget. And Stan Soloway is with us. He's president of the Professional Services Council, an organization that represents private contractors to the government. Harry Truman warned in 1941, "I have never yet found a contractor who, if not watched, would not leave the government holding the bag." So, do we have enough people watching as $400 billion in contracts are put out every year these days? Brenda's calling from Hampton Roads, Virginia. Hi, Brenda. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have, first of all, a comment to make about the contracting out. As a government employee working for DOD in mm-hmm. the former Bush administration, that's when I saw the huge increase in contracted positions of federal employees.
And was it working? Was it a good thing as you saw it, Brenda?
Well, it seemed to be in the beginning, but as time went on and more positions were contracted out, contracted employees began to be hired into technical positions like IT, then even though they were well qualified and well educated, there was a huge learning curve when they came in.
Mm-hmm.
And many times these employees have to be trained only for the contract to be ended a year or two later. You know, a government employee is training that person, a government employee who was making less money than this contracted employee.
So what's the solution? If they had the technical expertise you needed but not the context in the workplace, how do we put this together in a reasonable way, Brenda?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you that the government would have been better off to spend money retraining or continuing to train, especially in technical fields, than to hire consultants and have government employees train them on their service-specific type software, and then those people leave.
Making less money and then watching them float away. Brenda, we've got it. Let me get one more call here from Columbia, South Carolina. Rob, you're on the air.
Hi, yes, I think I have a similar point. I think what I've noticed and what's been my experience is that there's a lot of money on the table for former enlisted soldiers in the situation we have in Iraq.
Former enlisted soldiers now working as contractors?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Doing the same exact job, but making and the positions that I was involved in, $120,000 to do the same exact job that you did a few years earlier as an enlisted soldier. So your previous guest talked about, you know, the plumber and the quality
mm-hmm.
issue.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have the same plumber. And my point was that, you know, I guess this is a major long-term issue, but, you know, the same thing that's always occurred is that, you know, you don't get paid that much in the military. And now it's you're getting the same person, but the taxpayer is paying probably three times as much money for the same person.
What's the impact of that on the active duty military man or woman, Rob, watching that work go on at much higher pay right next to them?
Well, I think that they're, you know, unless they have some kind of pay, you know, stop pay loss where they can't get out, they're looking to cash in. I know a number of people who have cashed in.
You mean leave to get in the private side themselves? So one more call and we'll go to our panel. Melissa from Charleston. Hi, Melissa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I really enjoy your show and you.
Thank you.
Just kind of a comment similar to the last two callers. I worked as a contractor to the Navy for only 3 years, so it's kind of limited experience.
So you were on the private contracting side, all right.
Yes. And in my, like I said, 3 years, what I witnessed was that contractors are a huge benefit to the government, especially in the program management aspect. And I did kind of notice that contractors could definitely sway the government as far as the decisions, big ones, little ones, any decision.
Private contractors essentially helping make policy, is that a good thing, Melissa?
Well, I don't know if I would say it's a good thing, but the government employees seem to really want that feedback. So they were asking for it as much as government contractors were giving, I mean, as much as the private contractor was giving it. And also what I noticed, I'm trying to keep it short, a lot of the older workforce, mm-hmm. government employees.
Mm-hmm. As Stan was saying, it's getting older.
They seem to be, no kidding, sleeping on the job, playing solitaire. But a plus was, especially the base that I worked at, they were recruiting younger college graduates, very smart guys, but really tech-oriented.
As public or private employees, then?
They were going to be government employees.
So there may be a new wave coming in. Melissa,
correct.
Thanks for that. All right, we've got a lot on the table here. Angela.
Tom, if I may jump in real quick, and I agree with what your callers are saying. I even agree with what Stan is saying. That at POGO, we're not just pointing a finger at the contractors. This is a government issue that the government must solve. This gets into waste, fraud, and abuse. But it's not that the contractors are necessarily doing it and it's willful all the time. Sometimes there are instances and some bad apples out there. But does the government have enough people in its workforce to monitor, to administer, to oversee these contractors and the work that they're doing? And that is a big question. We've seen contractors, the number of contractors mm-hmm. based on some surveys, jump three times into the $7 million range. But we've seen an acquisition workforce that has leveled off or even slightly declined that's in the $20,000 to $30,000 or $30,000 range. So we have the same amount of federal overseers monitoring more people and more dollars, and that's one of the biggest problems that we have here.
Well, Scott, let me ask you. I mean, years ago when it was less in the private sector, it's not as though there weren't tons of complaints about, you know, how the public sector delivered on its promises to the American people. So What are we learning about an ideal ratio here? Has it swung too far? Are we going to have a more private sector-oriented government in the future, Scott? Do we need to push back and bring more public sector presence in order to have a kind of adequate controls and oversight of the private contracting, Scott?
Well, that's what we're seeing right now. We saw a lot of changes in the 90s and the early 2000s, and now we're kind of seeing a leveling off. Even there are inspector generals out there that have said, you know, no more new acquisition reform, no new rules, no new regulations until our current system can kind of catch up to all the changes that we've had, the outsourcing that we've seen. Our system really needs to grow, and we're kind of going through that growth spurt right now. But at the same time, we need to catch up with all that growth and make sure that we're doing it efficiently and effectively.
Stan Soloway, your group's members spend a lot of money on lobbying. Of course, Americans may have the fear that they'll buy their way into these contracts, into their work, and the system won't work to weed them out if they should be weeded out, or if the ratio of public to private work being done here is out of balance. Can we still be confident that this is self-correcting if the government's got all the problems you're saying it has?
Well, it's it doesn't need to be self-correcting. I mean, what Scott just said is consonant with everything Angela and I have been saying, and if our focus, because we all recognize that we've got this big challenge, and a lot of it is workforce related, if our real focus was on how do we best structure and train and skill a workforce to go manage this, I think we'd all be in the same boat. The problem
but we're
is
not there. Angela's saying it's out of whack. The volume's too big. We can't keep proper rein on it.
Well, but what I'm talking about is what Scott's point a moment ago about mm-hmm. what we need to do is focus on getting the workforce and the structure in place to manage this, because this is the reality of the new face of government. And if we focused on that, I think we could make a lot of progress and get a lot of return. The problem is because of politics and other things, you see all these proposals out there to substantially change the rules, backslide the rules and so forth, which I think will actually cost a lot of money. But one point I did want to make is I think the second caller made a very interesting point about the military issue. And the former soldiers coming back and doing similar work at a much higher salary. And there's really two factors there. First, it's not clear that the total cost of the government are any different or any greater, because the soldier doing the contract work is only there for a year or 2 years or what have you, as opposed to the permanent cost of a lifetime soldier with permanent health care and so forth. But the other issue is the military has made a very clear decision that it cannot afford to recruit and train and retain active duty to be doing a lot of the support functions that contractors have now been brought in to do, that the sheer costs are impossible and getting the numbers of people in is impossible. And so when we talk about when Senator Kerry was running in 2004, talked about adding 40,000 soldiers to the Army, he was talking about 40,000 soldiers to help on the military operations, not the support functions. So the military, separate from the rest of the sort of the civilian side of government, has made some very clear decisions that they need to rely on contractors to do that. And yes, the day-to-day, month-to-month costs of an individual will be higher, but that doesn't mean the total life cycle costs are higher for the job being done. But I think we all agree that transparency and accountability is important. We should be skeptical, Tom, as you said. I don't ask anybody to believe me or any individual company that belongs to our organization. We should be outraged at some of the waste we see in the system, but we've got to focus on what the root causes really are. And I think if we focus on that, which really is around structure and workforce and not around the assumption that every time somebody makes a mistake that there's a huge scandal or fraud taking place, we could make a lot of progress.
Angela Stiles, you couldn't blame listeners for being concerned about dysfunction here. On the one hand, Stan Soloway is saying the U.S. military could not do what needs doing in Iraq without a lot of private contracting support. On the other, we go to T. Christian Miller, and he says it's Exhibit A of why this contracting isn't working well. If it doesn't work this way and it doesn't work that, what is the situation? What is this reality of the new face of government we're facing, Angela?
Well, I think everyone has to face the reality. I think a lot of people don't even want to recognize that in order for us to have a military operation, that we must have a significant civilian workforce that's there. You know, a lot of people won't even admit that the workforce is as large as it is and that there are problems that have to be solved. I mean, you have people that'll be sitting side by side and doing the same job. One of them is governed by criminal sanctions regarding the ethics that they mm-hmm. have to follow. Can they accept lunch? Can they accept coffee? That would be the government employee. Mm-hmm. The other employee doing the exact same job sitting next to that government employee is governed by, you know, a contractor's ethical standards. What does that mean for us? I think we all have to be willing to have a conversation about what that means and how we go forward with this mix, with this blended workforce. There's no reason it can't work. It does work, but we all have to be willing to sit down and talk industry has to be willing to sit down and say, this is the way we think it should work. This is the way we can do it right. This is the way we can serve the taxpayer. And the government has to be equally as open to saying, these are the problems that we see. This is what needs to be done. In an environment that's not pointing fingers at each other, mm-hmm. but recognizing that there's problems and figuring out how to solve the problems. I think part of the problem you do have now is that there is a lot of finger pointing. There is, you know, it seems a good amount of fraud. People do, however, seem to have political motivations for pointing out, oh, there are difficult contracts in this administration. Mm-hmm. We're going to make sure and make a political issue about it. People really just need to sit down together and frankly work out the problems and figure out how to move forward with the blended workforce in the best way we can.
Ben, just speak to us at a very fundamental level. And Iraq brings it totally home because the government people there, many of them, are in the military. They're committed, not just legally, it's even more than a legal commitment. I mean, we expect a kind of loyalty and integrity and fundamental commitment to the American interest there. The private contractor, by definition, they have to have a commitment to their bottom line. That's their obligation to their shareholders. So whether it's in Iraq or anywhere else, how does that ultimately work? Can you get a very large proportion of people whose bottom line is the bottom line and still have the loyalty, the commitment, the integrity we need in government, Angela?
Absolutely. I think you can. I mean, I think it's absolutely possible to have contractors there doing the job that they need to do. It's a question of how you manage those contractors, what your expectations are, what the rules are for them, and when they violate the rules, do you make an example of them? Do you show people that this is not the right way to do it? And does industry likewise look at it and say, you know, we're going to be a good company, we're working with the government, we're going to be a leader, we're going to show people how to do this right?
Is the balance working correctly today, though? I hear you saying it's not. The volume has become so big that we can't have exactly that kind of oversight.
I don't think the balance is working right today. I think you're seeing a lot of problems. You're seeing fraud. You're seeing waste and abuse because the balance isn't working right. It doesn't mean it can't work right. Mm. But I think it's a matter of people really sitting down in a non-political environment and figuring out how to make it work better.
Let's take a call from Saranac Lake, New York. Kate, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. There are four brief points I want to make. I'm a federal employee and a lawyer, and I've been for years and have been in a lot of meetings with contractors. I had to take a oath of loyalty. They don't. I would hear about their other customers. I don't know if they would talk about what they were doing for us to other people. Also, when the government hires contractors instead of employees, it enables them to lie to the American public and say, we have cut the number of workers, we're being diligent with your tax dollars.
We used to hear Bill Clinton say that very prominently.
And you hear the Republican Party say that we're for, slimmed down, efficient government. And in the meantime, they're hiring contractors at the rate that they're firing and not rehiring federal employees. Also, when contractors are killed over in Iraq or wherever, we're hearing 3,100 have been killed, 3,100 have been killed. Mm. How many it allows the government to lie to us as to the number who have gotten killed? How many contractors have been killed? The number of deaths are, it's not just beans, like somebody said the other day.
Yep, we're not just counting beans, that's for sure. Kate, our time is short, but we appreciate your call. Scott, you're the watchdog here. Stans Holloway says we've got to get the balance right. Angela says it's not right now. What steps do you recommend, Scott, to get the sort of things in line here, the influence and work of private contractors properly overseen so that the American people can feel confident that they're getting the right services at the right money and the right kind of integrity?
Well, I think the first thing that needs to be done is we definitely need to look at the workforce and look at hiring some additional people to come in that will supplement the acquisition workforce that we have now to ensure that the system can properly work. The biggest problem is we have too few people overseeing a lot of money, and there's a huge crunch right now because we're contracting out so much, because we are entering such complex contracts, that is there enough oversight and administration over the work that's being performed rather than the new work that we're trying to hire for and award to contractors? And that's where this khaki example with GSA and their suspension debarment office, they were advertised as not being highly skilled, or at first being highly skilled workers that needed to come in and take a look at inspector general reports and make decisions. And then all of a sudden I received a future email that said, no, they were only administrative. Well, if they were only administrative, they were hired, as you mentioned earlier, for $104 an hour. At that point, could we had a federal worker come in, which GSA now has hired people to come in and replace these temporary khaki employees. But we could have done that for a lot less than $104 an hour.
We've got a lot to keep an eye on here. We appreciate each of you helping us get a fix on it. Scott Amey with the Project on Government Oversight, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Stan Soloway at the Professional Services Council, president there. Stan, thank you for joining us.
Tom, thank you very much.
And Angela Stiles, now at Miller & Chevalier in Washington. Angela, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.